You're listening to KHOL out of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. What do we talk about when the world may or may not be ending and we need to figure out what's important, what really matters? Definitely one of those things is art and the art that we make. I spoke with an artist from Brisbane, Australia called Charlie Donaldson, and he was here as part of the residency program at the Teton Art Lab. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah. We just went to local and checked out the scene. He's been here for like 20 days, a little
something
less
like
than
that. Yeah. Like 20 something.
Yeah. 20 something. You're coming here from Brisbane. You're doing kind of a whirlwind tour of the US, Jackson Hole, Columbus, Kansas City, New York. You did San Francisco at the beginning.
I did, yeah.
And then Toronto.
Yep, that's it.
So really not the typical U.S.
No,
tour.
No, not at all. It's kind of, it just kind of grew out of, I did a residency last year in Finland, and I just met a lot of people there that I really wanted to see. So my friend Sophia Cordova, who is an incredible artist, like one of the best artists I've ever met, like so switched on, makes incredible work. I stayed with her in San Francisco, well, in Oakland. Mm-hmm. And then I was doing this. And then in Columbus, I'm seeing an artist who, he was an artist in residence here in October. His name's Gabe Kenny. I met him in Finland as well. He recommended the residency to me in Columbus. So I'm there for 4 weeks, then seeing a very old friend in Kansas City, then 8 days in New York, seeing some friends there, but really just kind of doing my own thing. And then seeing more people from the residency in Toronto for 3 weeks. That's going to be good.
So you've said that already maybe you're getting a little bit homesick for Australia.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
There's something about Brisbane that it's got a very specific feel to it. And I don't know how many of your listeners would have visited Brisbane or even Australia, but Brisbane's a subtropical city, so it's hot a lot of the year. There's something about when the sun sets and the twilight comes over the city that is so incredible. There's a feeling that it has there that I haven't felt anywhere else in the world. And it might just be nostalgia for my hometown and the fact that I've lived there my whole life and everyone feels the same way about their hometown. But I feel like there's something happening in Brisbane that people are really missing out on if they're not there. The art scene's incredible. The bars are incredible. The food's amazing. The layout of the city and getting around there is just really incredible. There's something about it that pulls me back every time. And it only took me 2 weeks to get homesick. I've been homesick for 2 weeks now. And yeah, it's a magical place to live. It's really beautiful.
If you had to choose an equivalent in the US, is there something that would be similar?
Not really sure. I don't think I've seen enough of it yet, but no, I don't think there's anywhere that I've really heard of that's close to it. It's just something about, I mean, it's incredibly warm summers, very kind of mild winters. The people there, at least the people that I interact with, are really wonderful. And I think the biggest thing is just, it's kind of the layout of the city. It's a very spread out city. The CBD itself, like the central business district, the downtown is quite small. Everything that you really want to see is in the outlying suburbs around it. So it's a very kind of suburb-driven city, but there's a lot happening in those suburbs and it's very easy to get around. So it's great.
So you said something that surprised me already, which was, I think everyone feels the same way about their hometown, which I don't think people all feel that way. I do.
Because, that's actually true. Yeah. I didn't even think of that.
You're from Brisbane. I'm from here. We have something in common across the oceans. We're both in our hometowns. What is that like? Why is it okay to still be in the town where you grew up?
I don't know. I think it comes down to your experiences in the town. A lot of people from Brisbane move to Melbourne. Melbourne's kind of the place that everyone moves to when they want to get away from their hometown. No one moves to Brisbane. No one moves to Sydney because it's too expensive. They always move to Melbourne. And I think there's something about feeling like you belong in a place that really drives the way that people kind of interact with where they're from. So if they really feel like they belong there and have had very positive experiences there, then they'll want to return to that place and they'll want to keep living there. Otherwise, they just, I can understand if people do want to get out of the place where they live. But I think there's always something that you associate with the feeling of your hometown. And even if it's bad, it's still your hometown. And that feeling will always mean something to you, I think. So I'm really thankful that my experience with my hometown is positive, that, you know, it's that I think about it all the time, and I'd love to go back there, and I can't wait to be back there. But it's still nice being able to travel, I guess. And I mean, it's, I wouldn't have dreamed of having this experience a year ago. I didn't think that I'd be here in Jackson Hole.
How old are you?
I'm 25.
Now, in your hometown, does it feel different than it used to feel?
Like, I think it does, but in a different way. I mean, a lot of my time in high school was driven on, I was a bit of a nerd in high school. I didn't really have many friends, and I grappled a lot with my sexuality and coming out in high school, that you know how people in high school are, that I was quite alienated and alone and isolated for the first kind of couple of years that I was there.
Because of your sexuality?
Yeah, like absolutely. It was kind of, I came out when I was 16 years old, and the first experiences I had with that was that there was another gay guy in my school who had come out, and the first thing he said to me was, "You're not really gay, you just came out for the attention." And that kind of just drove my entire experience for the next year after that, that I was considered to just be lying, and people would, you know, kind of call me slurs and didn't want to talk to me. So I really had no one. And then I don't know what it was, but over the summer, which for us is kind of our end of year break, so around from November through to February in 2006, 2007, I kind of fell in with this group of people who were very accepting, kind of came out of my shell a bit. And so because of that, I kind of had a little bit more confidence. So that enabled me to be a little bit happier with the person that I was, and was very comfortable being a weirdo, I guess. Yeah, it was kind of, it was around, you know, it was the kind of time for that. It was 2007 where being a weirdo started kind of being cool, I guess. So
I missed it. Darn it.
You missed it by that much, just a little bit. Yeah.
I heard someone say the other day, they had distracted people from their weirdness by being good at things. And that's definitely what I was doing. I was like, I'm so weird. I'm just going to like do good at math and do good at ski racing so people don't notice how weird I am.
Yep.
Now I'm just the weird. I don't know what that other guy's problem was telling you were doing it for the attention, but what was your real experience? How long had you known about your sexuality being quote unquote different from the norm? And then when did you find out that coming out was a thing that you were supposed to do?
I think it kind of started for my generation, at least. Obviously a lot of our experiences were driven by the internet. So for me, it was just kind of spending a lot of time on the internet and kind of realizing, you know, because I was very nerdy, I spent a lot of time on forums and, you know, just kind of like chat groups about video games and stuff like that. And that was kind of my first exposure to queer culture and stuff like that. I kind of like had an understanding. And the biggest thing for me, actually, and this is going to sound super dumb, but you need to keep in mind, take it with a grain of salt, it was just the era, DeviantArt. Do you remember that website?
Yes.
That was kind of my first very kind of wide exposure to that kind of, to the idea of queer culture and queer art and that kind of thing, and being happy with who you are. So I kind of had the feeling since I was about 14, but it was when I was, it was before I turned, just before I turned 16. It was in 2007, which is, 10 years ago, which is crazy.
No, it's like 2 years ago.
Oh, it's gone so fast. That I came out to my parents, and they were very supportive. Like it was, you couldn't have asked for a better experience.
It
wasn't like that at all. They did initially say, they were very shocked, incredibly shocked. They said to me, "Oh, we just think it's probably a phase." And my mother has actually said to me since then, she sat me down and said, "We didn't tell you that it was a phase, but like, you remember that kind of thing." And she definitely did. And I don't hold anything against them, because they've been the most supportive parents in the world, like the most wonderful people. Like I couldn't have asked for a better experience. But yeah, they kind of really didn't have a problem at all. Like aside from that initial kind of hiccup, they really did understand that it wasn't anything like that. And I had, you know, like grappled with it for a while, because I mean, being a 15-year-old kid and in a school full of straight people and not really kind of understanding why you feel this way. And I mean, the culture at the time was that you were told that it was okay, but at the same time, the homophobia that you faced was immense. Like it was incredible. Up until, I mean, I still face it all the time. Like you just hear
in Australia.
Yeah, yeah. Australia is Australia doesn't even have gay marriage yet. We've had debates on it. They tried to have something called a plebiscite, which is basically a fancy word for a government referendum where the government actually puts to a vote. It's an incredibly costly procedure to go through a plebiscite, and it didn't work the way that they wanted it to, in that there's two major parties in Australia, the Liberal Party, which is surprisingly the Conservative Party, and the Labour Party, which is the kind of left-wing party. The left-wing party, Labour, blocked it. So they said, no, we're not going to do this. This isn't the way to get marriage equality in Australia, which thankfully it worked out that way. Otherwise, it was going to achieve nothing. It was just going to basically continue treating homosexuals as second-class citizens, which is still the way they treat it in Australia. There's so many laws that I don't want to go into detail on it, but there's so many laws that kind of hold us back from living like real people. It's astounding that we're a first world country and we still don't have gay marriage. It's crazy.
I'm surprised.
Yeah, it's actually insane. The fact that it looks like it's not even on the horizon at this point. We can't even find an end point to our kind of struggle for trying to get this. And the thing that people don't really understand in Australia is that it's not really the fact that we want to get married. Because I don't know how many gay couples want to get married in Australia. I can't talk for everyone. I myself don't want to get married. That's the thing. It's a civil rights thing. It's not the fact that we want to. It's the fact that we can't. It's making us live like we're not human beings. We're treated like we're not as good as other people. And I think it's awful. Not to kind of downplay the issue, but I mean, there's infinitely worse human rights violations happening in Australia. Like there's,
in terms of the inhabitants treatment and the dynamic with native populations?
Not even that. Like immigrants. Australians really, really don't like immigrants for some reason. The kind of immigrants are treated in Australia as awful. The most recent atrocity to happen in Australia was a few months ago. A bus driver in Brisbane, who was Indian, was set on fire by someone. Someone got onto the bus and put this kind of threw this powder on him that reacted with the air and set him on fire. It's horrible. It's kind of horrible to live in a society like that where that kind of thing happens. And obviously, I don't want to kind of downplay the fact that people do really care about these awful atrocities that are happening towards Australian, you know, people who come to Australia looking for asylum or just looking for a better life, to live a better life, you know, become a part of our society, which, you know, we used to welcome them with open arms. It was a wonderful place for immigrants to come to because they were always treated equally. These days, the culture of fear that's been raised by the Liberal National Party, it's astounding that more people aren't angry about it, I think.
It sounds like there's a similar level of division happening there that maybe people here could understand.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't even want to get into Indigenous rights in Australia because it's the things that are happening to Indigenous people in Australia is horrifying. It's really hard to be proud of a country that you live in when things like when human rights abuses like that are happening to the traditional owners of the land. I mean, they've been there for thousands of years.
And you had mentioned that one of your very favorite artists is an Indigenous artist.
Yes, Sally Gabori. She is an incredible, she passed away a few years ago, but she was an incredible painter who only came to painting much later in her life. She was in her 70s, I think, when she started painting. The way that she paints is just so it's kind of imbued with this incredible emotional and spiritual sense to it, that it's paintings of the land that she loves, that the land that is traditionally ancestrally hers. It belongs to her family and her kind of like group of people.
Where do you feel like being part of a group that's not viewed as equal as you described? For instance, you have two brothers.
Mm-hmm.
You're the middle brother.
I'm the youngest.
You're the youngest. Yeah. How do you understand yourself when you're part of a population in a country where you're not given rights to be equal to them, for example?
I mean, I honestly consider myself to be incredibly lucky because I'm white and I'm male. So that's the kind of two things that I think kind of make me feel like any struggles that I'm having, as bad as they are, and I don't really want to understate the kind of issues that, you know, that the LGBTIQ.
Tell me about LGBTQI.
I just refers to intersex people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's kind of, it's always kind of there and in kind of Australian references to the to the whole kind of queer community. But
okay.
Yeah, I feel like my experience as a white male queer man are just kind of like, the best of what I can kind of take. And like, I've had problems and it happens. Like, you know, there's nothing I can really kind of complain about compared to the prejudice that other people have faced. Like, my worst kind of things that I've had happen is, you know, being followed home by guys shouting at me that I don't think even knew that I was gay, but they were sure shouting at me that I was in very vulgar slurs. And, you know, just even if they don't know, it's still a terrifying thing. And you know, it's kind of, you've got to be really careful of that kind of thing in Australia because it's still such a big thing. The internalized homophobia in Australia, it's massive. Like it's, and I can't imagine experiencing that from, you know, the experience as a queer woman or as someone who is transgender or as someone who is a person of color would just be unfathomable in Australia, the kind of prejudice that you would face as being any combination of those. So my brothers are very supportive. I've never really had any problems with them understanding where I'm coming from or when I do get annoyed about things. They're completely understanding of what I have to go through, which is, it's really great. Like I've had bad experiences with it. There's kind of casual homophobia that exists in Australia that people don't realize that they're being homophobic. And I guess it's kind of a strong term to apply to it, but it's not being tolerant, I suppose. I mean, it's kind of making gay jokes and then looking at the gay guy in the group and then laughing because it's so funny. Like that's, I've become quite acutely aware of that very recently in the last kind of year of my life, that it's the kind of thing that I think to myself, well, hey now, actually I have been letting this slide. I've been letting people get away with it because it's easier than having a conversation about it. I've been trying to push myself to actually have that conversation with people, not in a kind of argumentative or combative way, just kind of make them understand, hey, like this isn't actually the way that you should be thinking about me as a person. Like, you know, my sexuality doesn't drive who I am. And I think that, you know, you need to take kind of a step back and view this from my point of view, that when you make jokes like this, imagine, you know, how that must feel.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm. And that's, I think, it's an art to inform someone about something that could hurt a person's feelings or detract from a movement of progression.
Yeah.
In a way that doesn't threaten them.
Oh, and a lot of the time I found it, you can try as you might to not be combative and not to be argumentative, they'll always take it that way.
My parents think I suck because I'm always like, guys, actually, that's not politically correct. And they're like, eye roll.
Yeah.
And they're like, why are you getting so upset? It doesn't affect you. And I'm like,
exactly.
Ah!
That's exactly it. I have several trans friends in Australia that I don't really want to get into it a huge amount purely because I have no understanding of what they must go through on a daily level of how hard it is to be a trans person in the world. I'm not going to lie. I've been called out on it before because I referred to someone that I know as the wrong pronouns and I didn't even realize what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And being called out on it is the best way to learn from it. You don't take it as an insult. You take it as a way of bettering yourself. Mm-hmm. And that changed me completely, that experience, because I didn't even realize that what I was doing was transphobic. So it was a really wonderful thing to kind of be called out on it and learn from it and grow from it. But a lot of the time, people just don't take it that way. My most recent experience with it was someone used the F word referring to a gay man around me. I called them out on it and said, that's a really inappropriate word to use. Please don't just shout it out in a room, because that's what they did. And then they got very combative and acted as if I had done a really horrible thing for calling them out. And their justification was, it's just a word. It's, you know, it only, you know, will hurt you if you give it meaning. It's like, well, when you think about the history of the word and how it has been traditionally used, then I'm completely justified in being annoyed, because you say that you're just using it in the sense that you think that your friend's stupid or doing something dumb, or it's like kind of to put someone down by using that word is that you think that being gay is an insult and that you think that it's funny. So you definitely use it in that context. And they definitely had. And they just really weren't happy about being told that what they did was incredibly offensive.
And I understand. Yeah. It doesn't feel good to be like, oh no, I did bad.
But no, not at all. Yeah. And like, but sometimes that's just the only way people learn. Like, I don't know if I'll ever see that guy again. I don't know if he'll stop using the word that way or if it will make him even more overt in his use of the word. But I did what I could. I think I'd feel worse if I hadn't, because you need to call out prejudice whenever you kind of experience it.
Right. I heard recently the differentiation between getting called out and getting called in. And so, for instance, if they're if you could call someone out in front of an entire group of people, would that be effective, or would it be more effective to pull them aside and say, hey, that hurt my feelings and here's why, or that's, you know, that's not a term that I'm comfortable with you using and here's why, or,
yeah,
you know, I private think always, message versus public. Yeah. And I don't think that it's always a call in that's right.
Mm. I think it's a situational thing. Yeah. Like it's definitely a situational thing, because I don't think doing it in a public sphere is, it sometimes isn't helpful, because it can just kind of make things worse. For me, it definitely has made things worse, because it, some people don't want to hear it, and then the people around them don't want to hear it either. So it can just definitely make it worse. But to do it privately, quietly, they might still react the same way, but at least you're trying in a way that isn't as combative.
I ask myself, sometimes it feels good to, like, if we're afraid of feeling shame, to make someone else feel shame.
Hmm.
Will they feel shame, and is that necessary for me to communicate what I need to communicate?
Shame isn't a very good way to educate people, I think.
No.
Because it's just, it makes people feel really bad, and, like, mm-hmm. you want to get the point across, but you want it to be a positive experience that they right. learn from it, rather than being mm-hmm. an intensely negative experience. And
yep.
it took me a while to learn that. I've reacted very negatively to homophobia that I face, and I've had friends of mine do the exact same thing. And while it's sometimes wonderful to watch, I watched a friend of mine punch someone in the face because they called me the F word once, and that was beautiful. At the end of the day, it doesn't achieve anything. It, you know, it's a great story to tell, but that person wouldn't have gone off feeling any better about the situation. They weren't given any information, and they weren't kind of like made to feel the error of their ways and mm-hmm. why their actions can kind of be detrimental to the mental health and of other people.
I heard recently this writer, he's lovely. I think he's French, Alain de Botton. He said, change happens under conditions of tenderness, not under conditions of embarrassment.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is KHOL, and you're listening to Notes for the Apocalypse, a show, an interview series, we'll call it, that might not prepare you for an actual apocalypse, but hopefully it will make you feel less alone. And this is a conversation I had with Brisbane-based artist Charlie Donaldson. He was in Jackson doing his art. Okay, so speaking of which, you and I have something else in common, which is we both have experienced a curvy stage in our lives, aka we've both been heavier or overweight before.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about what that was like.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of grew up being a little bit bigger always, and it kind of took me until I left high school to realize that I wasn't actually that big. I mean, I think I weighed, I don't know what it is in pounds, but I weighed about 85 kilos in high school, which is, it's fine. Like, that's exactly what you want to weigh. I think I'm 6'3". So that's kind of exactly what you want to weigh as a 17, 18 year old. But then kind of obviously beer happens, and beer happens a lot. And I was never really much for exercising. I spent a lot of time on my computer or drinking or going to shows. So I didn't really exercise at all. So I put on a lot of weight after I finished high school. And up until about 2016, early 2016, late 2015, I didn't exercise whatsoever. And I went to the doctor for a completely unrelated thing. And he kind of told me, you are technically obese. And that was a big thing to hear. Like, that's a really hard thing to hear, because I had always struggled with my weight. Had gone through phases. Like, there was, I think in probably 2013, I quit drinking for about 2 months and I lost 20 kilos, which I think is about 40 pounds, around 40 pounds.
From not changing anything else.
I stopped drinking and I started like only really eating like protein. So because of that, like, I just cut everything out and I wasn't eating any vegetables. So I just got really sick. So after that, I kind of kept putting it on, and I think my peak weight was, oh my God, I really don't know what it is in pounds. 265 pounds, I think, was my heaviest, which is in December in 2015. Because of that, I started cycling. Cycling has been a really, really incredible thing for me. It's like the best thing to ever happen to me. I really love it so much. I cycle 100 kilometers to, probably around 100 kilometers a week every week when I'm in Brisbane.
Just to get from where you're going.
Yeah,
to
and like going. I'll go on rides as well. Like I kind of meet up with friends and we'll do like there's a few kind of set really kind of classic rides in Brisbane. The best one being the River Loop, which kind of follows the Brisbane River all the way around. Yeah, over the course of the last kind of year and a bit, I've lost 45 pounds or something. So it's really great. It's a great feeling to. I feel so much better about myself and that kind of way that you feel. Yeah, like it's a really bad way to feel. I don't like feeling bad about myself, but it's the one thing that I still even today, like, you know, just being here for 3 weeks, I haven't been able to ride at all. And I've just been beating myself up about potentially putting on weight. It's still just kind of always present there in your head that you never want to kind of backslide to that because it's a really incredible thing to kind of turn your life around. And yeah, these jeans that I'm actually wearing, not that anyone can see, but
they look good.
I fit into a size 36 jeans, and a year ago I was in a size 42.
From doing something that you like, and it seems like you're motivated to do.
And, you know, I've still managed to keep up my degenerate lifestyle. I still drink too much and eat pretty well, but...
I guess, well, I came to it from a completely different end of the spectrum, which is I was always very athletic and active and never had ever thought about weight before until... I started to find comfort through emotionally eating, I guess I would say. And so came to be, I called it my Christina Aguilera phase. She's had some excellent curvaceous phases. And
she has.
I was really trying to bring like a positive self-love aspect to it. And that's one thing I really found is that I really learned to cultivate my personality, my humor, who I was outside of my physical presence.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of young women learn to understand themselves exclusively through their physical presence. So I'm not saying I recommend it, but I do recommend understanding that you have value outside of your body.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that always kind of came into it for me that I had friends who didn't see me in that way at all. Like they didn't see me as being someone who was overweight. But then when I lost the weight, they were just like, wow, like, yeah, you look amazing. And it's something that people, you really do want to surround yourself with people who don't really take their, you know, they don't kind of gain value from you for being, you know, physically the person that you are. I think people just have to be comfortable with who they are and just kind of understand that your worth doesn't come from that. For me, it was just kind of the act of finding kind of a sport that really worked for me and that I really, really enjoyed helped me to just kind of live a slightly healthier lifestyle. Which I think it came from that. It wasn't wanting to look better or anything. It was really just from a health point of view, which I think is it's the best way to approach it from. You don't need to do it because of the way that you look. You need to do it from how you kind of feel mentally. And if it helps your mental health, then it's a great thing. If it doesn't, then you don't need to worry about it. You just got to be comfortable with who you are, I think. Yeah.
That's so well put. I haven't phrased it out loud, but in my mind, I phrased it as like, what does a day look like that makes me the best person, the best self for my family and my friends?
Yeah.
And yeah, that includes a mom walk, being outside for 20
and
to
sometimes you can't escape
30 minutes.
Your body dysmorphia. Sometimes it's just you're gonna have days where you don't feel good about yourself, and everyone has that. Like it just happens. Like I was having one yesterday. Like I felt really gross and like wasn't really happy with how I looked, and today I feel great. Like it's, you know, it's you've just got to take it as it comes and just understand that that's not where your self-worth should be tied up.
And do the things that make you feel healthy, like you said.
Exactly.
Just to keep on the super exciting, upbeat themes, anxiety.
Oh, yes. It was something that really didn't become apparent for me for a long time. I was quite kind of confident through high school, but it just kind of became very apparent to me that it was something that was really holding me back. Overthinking situations was always really, really making me feel crazy anxious all the time. And what other people thought of me, someone would just kind of look at me in the street and I'd think, oh, like, you know, what did I do? And I still do that a bit, but not as much now. But I used to have, it was a few years ago, I wasn't really having the best time in my, you know, in terms of my career, and I really didn't think anything was going to happen for me. I didn't have a job. I was feeling just not really great about myself. That was when my anxiety really kind of hit a huge point where I was having, like a few anxiety attacks every couple of weeks, was trying to, and I was actively trying to force myself to leave the house just so I wouldn't spend all my time at home, because it was not really a healthy way to live. But I mean, the biggest thing for me is just that I went to my doctor and said, I'm really anxious all the time. I think that it's making me depressed and I don't want to be depressed. What can I do about this? And he's like, well, I mean, I can send you to talk to someone about it, but I think that all you need to do is just think positively and just kind of work through it yourself. And thankfully that worked for me. It might not have worked for a lot of people, but thankfully that's what worked for me. And
as the anxiety ties into making time to cycle and do your art and nurture
and just
yourself.
Feel better about myself and understand that, it's just not always me, I guess. Like, that was the biggest thing, was realizing that people aren't always looking at me. I would hear someone laugh in the street and think that they were laughing at me, and that had sent me into a spiral for a good couple of hours.
That's why I was laughing when you said you were being what did I do?
It's like a huge thing, isn't it? It's awful. Yeah. And you don't even realize that that's a mental health issue until you realize that anxiety is a crazy thing. And, you know, being forced into situations, I used to not really have any issues with crowds. Now I really hate being around crowds. They make me incredibly uncomfortable. Taking the time to think about the things that make you happy and the things that make you unhappy, and realizing which ones you can actively remove from your life that will make you feel better. And sometimes it's little things. For me, it's, I stopped actively going to bars to drink and going to clubs and stuff, because I would want to be around my friends, but I would be incredibly uncomfortable at the same time, and I wouldn't want to be there. It was easier to kind of separate myself from those situations and work out the situations where I could see my friends and not feel awkward and not feel anxious about it.
What
is
it about crowds?
I don't know. I think it's a lot of the times when I'm around big crowds, it's when I'm at a music festival, or I'm at a bar, or I'm at a gig, or a club, for lack of a better word. So it's kind of being around people that I don't know who are incredibly drunk, and Australians are a very confident people, and they'll try and talk to you and they'll be very kind of accidentally rude, I guess is the best way to phrase it. You can just kind of get surrounded by people that make you incredibly uncomfortable. Specifically, for me at least, very drunk young people make me very uncomfortable.
Why?
It's the confidence that they have and the way that they try and get you to do things. Like, my least favorite thing that someone does, and I always have crazy anxiety whenever someone does that. You ever have that thing where you're walking down the street and maybe it's just a very Australian thing, but someone's like, oh, hey man, you want to give me a high five? And they try and high five you and you're just like, I really don't want to high five you. And then they get really belligerent about it. That's the kind of situation that I'm referring to. And it happens so often in Australia, at least in Brisbane. It's a really big thing for people to do that. And they don't understand. I think that people just don't understand the effect it can have on other people. It's a dumb thing that they do, but it's that kind of thing makes me incredibly anxious, because I don't want to interact, if it's 11 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 1 a.m.,
right,
and someone's asking me for a high five, and I'm like, I just want to get the bus home. I don't want to talk to you at all. It's kind of, it can.
To them,
it's
a random cool connection.
Yeah.
And to you.
And to me, it's represent... please don't talk to me. I don't want this at all. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense. You're listening to Notes for the Apocalypse on KHOL. I'm Cassandra, and I chatted with Australian artist Charlie Donaldson, as you can tell by his groovy accent. How does your art fit into all the other aspects of your life? It's the primary focus of your life.
I mean, I actually think that it sits quite separately from it. There is a degree of anxiety that kind of comes up within my work, but I think it's manifested in a different way. But I've never felt comfortable making I really feel like my, and this is going to probably sound dumb no matter what way no matter what way I phrase it, but I've never really felt comfortable having my sexuality be a big part of my art practice, just because I feel like my experiences that I've had aren't really interesting enough. And that probably sounds, that's an incredibly dumb thing to say, but I've just never really found it to be that big a part of my life that I've wanted to make artwork about it. And so I've just never really touched it. So a lot of the work that I make is about conspiracy theories as kind of the main aesthetic of it. But the main thing that I talk about in my work is kind of the way that we approach images in the 21st century, the way that they exist in this kind of collapsed, networked space that's very different from the kind of linear space that images used to exist in before the internet happened. So there was always a very linear narrative of reading images that happened in you know, pre-internet. So it was, you'd see them in magazines, in books, in, you know, movies, TV, billboards, stuff like that. It's a very linear way. You had a situation where you read an image, and that was the situation that it existed in. It didn't really exist in any other form.
For me, I like to buy a lot of magazines from the 60s, like women's magazines, and it'll be a woman in a brassiere.
Mm.
And I'm thinking of one in particular, obviously. So there's the woman in the brassiere, and you're already like, oh, she's confident and cool, and that's not too sexy. It seems supportive. Then next to it's like, and I think the tagline is like, behind every Olga bra, there's an Olga lady who's designing it for you because she's a woman and she knows you. And you're like, okay, got it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, you know, when that kind of thing happens on the internet now, you might, for example, Google something like brassiere. I wouldn't Google that. That'd be kind of weird for me to do, I think. might come up with some weird results. But it's the kind of thing that if you Google something like that, go into Google Images, those algorithms that are running those systems for that particular word, they're basically running off a system that's going to look for that word, similar words, and similar images. Those are the three things that it's always looking for. So a lot of the time, those systems just are completely faulty. They don't work. You kind of look up anything, and the system that is working for that kind of image, or even for things that you buy, for things that it thinks that you want to buy, or things that you want to learn, or things that you're trying to learn, for things like hashtags, for example. Anyone can hashtag anything in a system. It's always going to be a complete random kind of mass of images. And it's the same thing for Google Images. You'll find similar stuff, but the context and the origin of it is completely different. So because of that, those systems can often, you know, become faulty. And I'm very kind of interested in the way that we can kind of glean information from these faulty systems of kind of like associating images together. So how I can kind of take control of them as a means of storytelling. So that specifically means that I kind of spend a lot of time data mining. I'll kind of go on Google Images and just type in some random kind of terms and just download images to go with that. And then after I've amassed, say, 200 images, I'll really just kind of sit there and sift through it and work out which ones are starting to reveal themselves to me in kind of a narrative timeline. So a lot of my work is very timeline-based. It's kind of making conspiracy theories out of these randomly mined images. And of course, conspiracy is a great realm to explore this kind of thing in, because there's a cognitive leap that I think happens when people view conspiracy theories and think about conspiracy theories. There's a kind of magical thinking that people have to suspend their disbelief for a lot of it to make sense, because a lot of it is completely absurd, insane things that doesn't make any sense. That's become a little bit more of a contentious issue in the last couple of months. You look at Trump and, you know, fake news, alternative facts and things like that. But I've always kind of tried to approach it with a sense of humor, that it's a funny thing, and it's fun and it's interesting, and it's a way of revealing something hidden about our world, the way that we kind of approach these images and alternate ways of looking at the world, as long as it's not kind of to cause harm.
You had something about Harrison Ford that you posted.
Yeah.
What was that?
Just early on being here, I found out that Harrison Ford lives here, which was just insane to me. Like, I couldn't believe it, that he actually spends, like, I'm in a town where Harrison Ford spends a lot of time. So I kind of made a work that was about, I made kind of a really big timeline about kind of a lost gold mine that's co-opted by the government for nuclear testing and virtual reality testing, and then a cult finds it, and then there's treasure hunting company decodes the cult's clues to try and find the site of it, and then they all disappear. Not to give too much away, but and Harrison Ford played an integral role in this timeline that I've made, in that he was doing a search and rescue mission and came across these stones that this cult had left that led this team of treasure hunters to their kind of former mining site. It's always a fun thing when associations like that kind of pop up just from talking to people in the town and understanding kind of the stuff that goes on here. It's just such a bizarre thing to have happen, but it fits so perfectly into making these kind of like big kind of weird sweeping conspiracy theories.
Right. And I feel like when you describe the concept, it's very intellectual. And then when you describe it like that, I'm like, that sounds like the next installment of one of his movies, you know?
And it's a very Indiana Jones thing.
Right. Yeah. Yet when you say conspiracy, I think some people get scared.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's the way that I think about conspiracy is that it's in the context of America, at least, and I was talking to Brennan about this as well, it's kind of it's the contemporary version of like folk tales within America, I think. Mm-hmm. Like America's a country that's very like built upon its folk stories and its urban legends to kind of build this this mystery of America and what America as a continent is like. And you look at things like, you know, I mean, you start out with tall tales like Paul Bunyan and things like that. But the contemporary version of that is things like Bigfoot. It's lost expeditions. It's the, you know, it's UFOs, it's Roswell. Like that's the contemporary kind of American folk historical canon.
Right.
When you look at that kind of thing, and it's all kind of there to draw people into this myth of America as this like really, you know, like incredible place. And that's not to say that it isn't, like it is a really incredible place. There's so much good happening here to go with the kind of awful stuff that happens too. I mean, I think it's the same as anywhere, but yeah, it's the one place where these kind of conspiracy theories are really given a lot more time than anywhere else, because a lot of them originate from here, I think. And it's a very kind of interesting and I think important kind of thing to be looking into, because it gives us insight into the way that we approach information in our everyday lives, to look at the way that conspiracies are worded and the way that conspiracies exist on the internet is to really be given insight into the way that we approach everything, because images kind of, yeah, they kind of drive everything in our everyday lives now.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's every form of media is a very image and video driven media.
I remember Googling something this summer, earlier this summer. I think I was Googling, why do I lose more hair in the summer? And the first five things that came up were like, why do I have diarrhea? Why do I suck? Why don't I have any friends? And I was like, oh my God, is this
what people
because
are,
of who I am? Or is this where all my peers are at? What's happening with
it's
this?
Just what people Google, I guess.
Yeah. Just
a lot of people
have
diarrhea.
We're all bald, diarrhea, friendless,
sad
people.
Yeah.
Hey, it's fine.
I've seen so many good ones of those, but I can never remember them off the top of my head.
Maybe we can find some and then recite them at the end of this episode.
There was an amazing one it's a very popular meme. It's just the one's like, when did PDF become the, you know, the one of the most popular religions in the world? And it's like, how do I convert to Judaism, Islam, Christianity, Buddhism, PDF? It's like, yeah, I think that's really great.
You kind of go to church without knowing it. If you, or have you, described Jackson Hole to your friends and family back in Australia, what would you say?
I mean, before I came here, no one knew where it was. So, like, just no one has any idea. But, like, yeah, in Australia, this is kind of like, it seems like a lot of Americans know where Jackson Hole is, but no one in Australia has any idea where it was. But if I were to describe it, it's pretty, I don't know, this is my limited experience, but it seems pretty laid back. Like, I mean, it could be the time of the year, but people love to have a beer.
That's
like
accurate.
To kind of walk around. And I mean, skiing and snowboarding, I guess, is the big draw for people here. That's not really an interest of mine, but I understand why people like it. And I've heard a lot about how there's a lot of money in this town. That's one thing that's been kind of reiterated to me a lot by people, is that there's a lot of money here. And I can
by
really see that.
By people with money or by people with
just
less
by
money?
Just by people who live here. Just people who live here. Pretty much everyone that I've talked to about it has said, yeah, like Jackson's got a lot of money going into it, which is, it's understandable. There's a huge tourism industry here. And I mean, I can see it. It's evident in almost everything here. But it's funny, people saying to me like, oh, it's so expensive here. Wait until you get to Columbus, it'll be so cheap. And I just think it's so cheap here compared to Australia. Like, it's unbelievable paying nothing for a beer or a meal or anything like that. I mean, it's we get taxed so heavily in Australia, which is, it's a great thing. It's a really good thing. I mean, we have healthcare, really, really affordable and you know, public healthcare. Our minimum wage is like $25 an hour, which is wonderful for anyone working in a service industry. I mean, aside from working as an artist, I work in retail. So being able to be paid $25 an hour and save up enough of my money from that to come and visit America is a, you know, it's something that I feel like I'm very lucky to be able to do. So yeah. That's really what I've heard about Jackson. I describe it to people as a very beautiful town. It feels really quintessentially American to me. It's exactly the kind of thing that I expected, but in the best possible way, which is great.
Well, thank you for visiting our town.
No worries,
and for making the time to chat with us.
I've really enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
That was artist Charlie Donaldson coming to us via Brisbane, Australia. He'll be traveling around the U.S. You're listening to Notes for the Apocalypse. We're doomed, but it's going to be fine.